Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, this is Liz Ishii, and you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. As always, we're going to start off the show covering the headlines from a socialist perspective. And then in the studio today, we have Lauren Pennington, and she's going to be talking about the guiding principles for a Green New Deal that the DSA eco-socialists have put together and put out in the world. And we also have Gustavo Gordillo in the studio, and he will be talking about the work that the Eco-Socialist Working Group is doing right here in New York City. So let's start with the headlines.
Extra, extra, news from the Thorn. Representative Gregory Meeks, New York 5, was elected to replace former Representative Joseph Crowley as boss of the Queens County Democratic Party. Meeks, an ally of Crowley and the establishment, has been plagued by corruption allegations of accepting improper gifts and spending frivolously on travel using campaign funds. De Blasio's 2020 city budget proposal includes hiring freezes and a significant funding cut to HPD due to fears of loss in tax revenue. While Governor Cuomo is calling on the state legislature to include marijuana legalization in this year's budget, some county executives, including Nassau County's Laura Curran, have indicated that they would opt out of any statewide law permitting the sale of recreational marijuana. Mayor de Blasio introduced a plan to extend the shoreline of Lower Manhattan into the East River as part of a coastal resiliency strategy. The plan would cost $10 billion and require federal funding. Councilmember Margaret Chin, District 1, Lower Manhattan, expressed skepticism that this plan would benefit private real estate developers and destroy waterfront communities. Representative Carolyn Maloney, New York 12, appeared at a rally in opposition to efforts by sex workers and some state lawmakers to decriminalize sex work in New York State. The rally included an openly transphobic group, which Maloney later condemned. Hudson Yards, a massive public land giveaway engineered by the Bloomberg administration, finally opened after a decade of construction. The New York Times excoriated the complex, which almost entirely consists of luxury residences, investment properties, and high-end retail. In elections news, sex work decriminalization has become a prominent issue in the Queens District Attorney race, with DSA endorsee Tiffany Caban and former prosecutor Jose Nieves voicing the strongest intent to decriminalize among the candidates. In These Times highlighted DSA's organizing around Tiffany Caban's campaign for Queens District Attorney. Ahead of the expiration of New York's rent regulation laws, a coalition of progressive and socialist activist groups have threatened to primary the co-chairs of the Democratic Assembly Campaign Committee, Peter Abate, District 49, Bensonhurst, Joe Lentall, District 50, Greenpoint, and Jeff Dinowitz, District 81, Riverdale, unless they adopt a more pro-tenant and pro-labor agenda. Public advocate-elect Jumani Williams has named activist and former public advocate candidate Iffy Ike the head of his transition team. State Senator Mike Gianaris, District 12, Western Queens, and Councilmember Jimmy Van Bramer, District 26, Western Queens, both of whom publicly opposed the Amazon deal in their districts, appeared alongside Elizabeth Warren at her presidential campaign rally in Long Island City last week, where she pitched breaking up big tech monopolies like Amazon.
And also worldwide, over 1.4 million youth went on climate strikes. I was in New York City and talked to some youth climate strikers at Columbus Circle. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Sadia, I'm 15.
My name is Ava, I'm 15.
My name is Kaya, I'm 15.
Our entire lives, we've known about climate change.
even Democrats, you know, who say, like, oh, we believe in climate change, haven't really taken action. Like, what are you asking people to do?
I mean, I think, you know, because the main part of a walkout is to bring awareness to something. And the people, kids are doing this all over the world, and I think that's really important. I feel like that we're really a part of something special, and that us showing that, like, we're giving kids a voice, essentially, and I think that's a really big part of freedom of speech. And so I just hope that this brings enough awareness that people will actually start taking a stand and signing petitions, and we'll get things to the higher people in the government and to the White House eventually, because this is really insane how we're just brushing something that can possibly end us in a while just right off of our shoulders, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and, like, striking is actually, like, a really revolutionary tactic. Mm-hmm. Like, coal miners striked, and that's why we have, you know, a five-day work week. And do you feel a part of something much larger?
I definitely do. Time and time again, young people like us have been told that we can't do anything to change the world. And unifying all of us like this all around the world, as Kaya said, it's something that really brings strength to us as a young generation. And it proves that we can make a change no matter what.
And how does it feel that so often that, like, the greed of fossil fuel corporations are somehow, like, more important than our futures and our lives? How does that feel? And what do you want elected officials to do?
I think that it's kind of appalling how money is so much more important, and how greedy these companies and the government and people in the government can be. That money and how much they make and their profit is more important than the lives of, like, the countries that, like, all over the world. Like, this is just, it's stressful, you know, that we're not important anymore, you know.
And it was so incredible to see just thousands of youth filling this space, you know, like I said, joining in this very revolutionary tactic. You know, there's been teachers striking, nurses striking, and this very strong demand of that we need to listen to the science and we need action now. So I'm really excited to have Lauren and Gustavo in the studio today to talk about this thing that seems like everybody is kind of really talking about and a lot of people don't understand fully, which is the Green New Deal and the energy rights work that the New York City DSA eco-socialists are working on. So thanks so much for coming. Lauren, we like to kind of introduce people to who we are and the work we do. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in DSA and the work you're doing with DSA?
Sure. Thanks for having us, Lee. This is an amazing opportunity to talk about, thank you, our work. So I first sent in my dues for DSA after the 2016 election. Since then, it's been a progressive increase in involvement. I think I didn't attend my first meeting until a few months later when I saw Kristen Nielsen get bird-dogged by some DSA members, and I was super impressed and inspired and decided to get off my butt and actually attend a meeting. And since then, I've attended meetings, I've gone canvassing. When the IPCC report came out this past fall, I joined the Eco-Socialist Working Group in New York and the National Eco-Socialist Working Group that lives on the internet.
What about you, Gustavo?
Yeah, so I followed a similar path after the 2016 election. I think I was first exposed to Marxist thought in college in a film class about radical cinemas of Latin America. But I actually never really thought that radical politics could be real, like a reality in the United States, until the 2016 election and shortly after I joined DSA. And actually for those years, you know, we were recently talking about how many of us in the Eco-Socialist Working Group are pretty new to eco-socialist organizing. Like, I was working in the art world for the past several years, and it was really a radicalizing experience, I have to say, to see what the ruling class does in its leisure time with the capital that they extract from artwork.
And you were saying you don't, Lauren, have a very strong energy background, but were able to plug in to the work that the eco-socialists have been doing?
Yeah. You know, I've taken one class maybe in atmospheric science when I was in college, and I couldn't tell you, you know, the main points basically besides how global warming works. But in my day job, I am an editor, and so I feel very comfortable just reading a lot of things and trying to make them into other different things. So I wanted to offer my time and skill set to the National Working Group specifically because they put together this campaign for Green New Deal. So I help create sort of presentations, like any sort of written material that they need, shared assets, and those all go to local chapters who may or may not have the capacity to create those things on their own.
And Gustavo, what's some of the stuff that you've done with Eco-Socialist in the time you've been involved?
We have been part of a coalition that's trying to pass climate change, a comprehensive climate policy in New York called New York Renews. And I helped organize one of the climate forums in Lower Manhattan. And now we're starting a campaign around energy democracy in the city, and to try to spread awareness of what our energy system looks like, what are the systemic injustices that undergird it, and how we can really contest these utilities and our energy landlords, basically.
Yeah, and you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we have Lauren and Gustavo in the studio, and we're talking about a Green New Deal. You can follow more. You can follow the Eco-Socialists at New York City DSA _ climate. And so we're going to kind of dig in a little bit more now into these guiding principles that the Eco-Socialist Working Group has put out on a Green New Deal. Lauren, can you talk a little bit about what that process was like to craft those? I mean, we know there was this huge media moment where AOC, kind of in Sunrise, put a Green New Deal on the map. I think a lot of people are still working through what this means. What was it like for the Eco-Socialists to create these principles and put them out?
Sure. So yeah, we were all sort of swept up in the excitement that politicians proposed this new framework for considering climate policy in America right alongside justice and equity and fighting inequality. But we also recognized that it created an opportunity for a greenwashing, corporate capture of this moment. We were specifically inspired by the responses that came up pretty soon after the announcement of the resolution from the Climate Justice Alliance, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and Cooperation Jackson, who put forward very eloquent pieces in defense of a Green New Deal that centers working communities, frontline communities, and that prevents it from becoming sort of green new capitalism in a nutshell. So we took that opportunity to consider what we thought an eco-socialist Green New Deal would look like. And the process was approximately 3 months long, I want to say. And as, somebody new to the group, I sort of took an observational role. I saw the process that the organizers who have been a part of that for longer put in place. And it was very deliberative. It was very inclusive. Everyone who had sort of something to add, they were heard out. So after a few weeks of considering what we wanted broadly, writers created a draft. That draft was circulated widely. And then we created a process for amending it. All said and done, people probably were getting antsy, like we wanted to put something out soon, but it was a learning opportunity for me because we saw how that democratic process enabled us to go to local chapters and get greater buy-in. It was an internal organizing exercise for ourselves. And in the process, we've created this document that we think will serve as a great platform going forward.
And it sounds like having it be a democratic process was a really important part of drafting this.
Absolutely.
And what did DSA come up with? Michael Bloomberg has his own Green New Deal. Washington Post has a Green New Deal. I'm guessing it's pretty pretty different than theirs.
It's very different. I'd say we created this document, Seven Principles. Each of the principles represents, I'd say, a major difference that the eco-socialist vision has versus the Green New Deal that was proposed by AOC, let alone, you know, Cuomo, Bloomberg, and everybody else who's coming in with their own proposals. So I'll just go over the seven principles and sort of comment on how it's different than the AOC resolution. So the first principle is decarbonizing the economy fully by 2030. That comprises every sector, not just energy. In the resolution itself, there's a nod to net zero emissions by 2050, but you know, the United States is historically responsible per capita for the most emissions. We have the technology and the resources to really be a first actor in this, and it's our responsibility to do the right thing. The second principle is democratizing control over the major energy systems and resources. And Gustavo will speak to this soon about the New York City's chapter's work related to this principle. The third is centering the working class in a just transition. The fourth is decommodifying survival. That includes education, housing, healthcare, our international view. So the sixth principle is demilitarizing, decolonizing, and striving for a future of international solidarity and cooperation. I skipped the fifth. The fifth is reinventing our communities to serve people and planet, not profit. And our final principle is redistributing the resources from the worst polluters. So I would say in each of those points, there is something that AOC's Green New Deal did not touch on that our vision is essential to our vision of an eco-socialist future.
Yeah, and like one of the things in reading the document that was put out, it talks about, you know, addressing the climate crisis and the inequality crisis together.
Right.
So how, you know, I'm sure this could be a very expansive subject, but, you know, how is climate change and capitalism related? Because, you know, as putting forth this eco-socialist kind of platform, we're also addressing not just how energy is created.
Correct. Yes. So in my understanding, and I've had to do a lot of learning and reading about this and educating myself, capitalism is the allows for individuals to take natural resources and put it towards private profit. The more profit you have, the more use of natural resources, burning fossil fuel. Essentially, economic growth is tied to the use of fossil fuel. The more growth you have, the worse climate change is going to get. And related to that, the people who are the richest, who have burned the most fossil fuel, are the most insulated from the effects of climate change. And that is the crux of the crisis we face currently.
And do you have anything you'd like to add about that, about the connections between capitalism and climate change?
Yeah, it's always staggering to see these maps that show where the effects of the climate crisis will be felt most strongly, and to realize that, you know, all of us in the Northeast, we're really not in line for nearly as much devastation as, say, the tropics, which could be uninhabitable in just a few decades. And the current economic system that we have does nothing to prevent this, you know, this almost inevitability. Like, corporations are free to continue emitting greenhouse gases and profiting from it, and shareholder value is the only priority, and we're really not taking into account the human cost that's associated.
Yeah, I kind of came to socialism through fracking because I saw so many people whose lives were destroyed, and you know they're actually paying the cost, and that's all. The companies are never paying that, and what we're seeing is these companies still pushing more fossil fuels despite the science that we see, and that includes frack gas pipelines. And so one of the things that Daily Beast has written about, The Guardian has written about, that Governor Cuomo's first test, you know, he came out and said he has a Green New Deal, and we can break that down a little bit more about how that doesn't fit with the eco-socialist vision. But he, you know, claimed a Green New Deal. And so a lot of people are saying that his first test will be whether or not to approve a pipeline off the coast of the Rockaways, the Williams-Nessie pipeline, which would bring frack gas from Pennsylvania into New York City. So we have a clip of Aaron Eisenberg, who is a member of the DSA Eco-Socialist Working Group here in New York City, giving public comment on the Williams pipeline. Here's Aaron.
The fossil fuels that will be transported through the proposed pipeline will not just go on to power homes and buildings, but will also supercharge the next storm that will hit New York. Fossil fuel companies have known for decades about the direct link between their product and the dangers they pose to all our futures. For this reason, they have spent years denying climate change, just like big tobacco spent big years denying the link between smoking and cancer. Well, our planet has been given a very serious diagnosis as well. And if we are smart, we will listen and act accordingly. The IPCC report put out by the world's top scientists and the UN told us we have 12 years to act on climate. The findings said that if we do not act now, we will have Hurricane Sandy level storms here in New York City every 5 years. Shouldn't we be putting our money and infrastructure into renewable sources that match the scope of the problem, rather than more fossil fuel infrastructure? The Williams pipeline not only poses a risk to future generations, it also poses an immediate threat to New Yorkers who are alive right now. Millions of people swim in the waters off of our coast. This pipeline will churn up arsenic, lead, DDT, and PCBs from the seafloor. I don't have to be a scientist to know that this is not what we need. There's still time to act, but this pipeline, or there's still time to stop this pipeline from being built. Governor Cuomo has the power to stop it now. He can deny the permits. We know that Governor Cuomo would like to be seen as a climate leader in this state and nationally. In fact, he has even proposed his own Green New Deal for New York. We are asking Governor Cuomo to deny the Williams pipeline the needed water quality permit and certificate to stop this pipeline. One thing is very clear to us. No new pipelines can be part of any Green New Deal, period. Yeah. A Green New Deal needs 100% renewable energy. A pipeline like this and a Green New Deal cannot exist in the same state. By denying these certificates and permits, you would be helping us pave a way for a green economy that places people and planet over corporate profits. So thank you once again for your time. Yeah.
That was Aaron Eisenberg of the New York City DSA Eco-Socialist Working Group. He was testifying at a hearing in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. The DEC, that's the Department of Environmental Conservation, if you're not super wonky into bureaucracy of Albany. So DEC had three hearings on these pipelines, two in Bay Ridge and one in the Rockaways, which is a community very close to where the pipeline would go. They were packed with people opposing the pipeline. People have also written comments to the DEC. They submitted over 10,000 comments opposing the pipeline. And now 60 New York City area elected officials, including all the elected officials in the Rockaways, many from Staten Island and Coney Island, which would be also very close to this proposed pipeline, have come out against it. And now the ball is in Governor Cuomo's court, and the DEC and Governor Cuomo have until May 16th to decide. And, you know, as Aaron said, if he's proposing a Green New Deal, there really can't be any room for the expansion of fossil fuels. But Governor Cuomo's Green New Deal has clean power by 2040. So that's really only focusing on the electricity sector, you know, the actual big power plants, the electricity that's coming into our homes, offices, and buildings. But the eco-socialists and the guiding principles have put forth decarbonizing the economy by 2040. Can you talk a little bit, Lauren, about what is the difference between just the electricity sector and decarbonizing the whole economy?
Sure. The electricity sector currently represents less than a third of all emissions. I want to say it's 24%, but I'll double check. And so we have to focus holistically on the entire economy. That includes our agricultural sector. That includes our industrial sector, which emits 31% of emissions, and our transportation sector, which I think is also around 24% of emissions. And so focusing on our electric generation emissions, it's just completely inadequate for what needs to happen in the speed and scale that it needs to happen in.
And in addition to that, Governor Cuomo has actually approved the expansion of frack gas infrastructure. There was two major huge power plants, one that just went online recently and one that's still being built in Dutchess County. Governor Cuomo's talking a big game here, but he's still approving frack gas infrastructure and fossil fuel power plants. What else about Governor Cuomo's Green New Deal doesn't really, Gustavo, doesn't really make the cut for you?
I think in general, this focus that kind of erases the context behind every business decision, that does not bring the human cost more into each decision. For me, I think land use is a really interesting thing to think about, like how we will have to, in order to truly transition our economy away from a carbon-intensive economy, we really need to think twice, for example, about building new highways and building housing that is not linked to public transit. Because a highway becomes essentially a form of fossil fuel infrastructure when it incentivizes, thousands of more cars and when we are displacing low income tenants from our city for the benefit of private real estate developers, if they're moving farther and farther away, their carbon footprint is getting higher and higher. Especially if they're having to be kind of expelled from the infrastructure that we have set up in New York and in no other city for public transit, really. I think that's...
Yeah, you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we have Lauren and Gustavo in the studio, and we're talking about a Green New Deal and energy rights. And so I kind of want to dig in a little bit. We went over the seven principles that the Eco-Socialist Working Group have put out on a Green New Deal. And the second one is to democratize control over over major energy systems and resources. I get really excited by that. That sounds amazing. Gustavo, can you kind of explain a little bit about what that actually looks like as far as the organizing that's happening with the Eco-Socialist Working Group here in New York City?
Yeah, so for me, someone who really influenced the way I think about organizing is Jane McAlevey, and I read both of her books when I was first getting involved in DSA, and basically I think it's really indispensable for all of us in DSA to be thinking every day about how we can reach out to people who are not part of the movement and encourage them to become part of our movements and our struggles. I think that DSA members are really important to do this because many of us don't come from these fields already. In energy, we just started this campaign in 2019, and a big first step was educating ourselves about what the energy system looks like. Basically, in New York, there is a commission called the Public Services Commission that regulates all of the investor-owned utilities in the state, and it's made up of five commissioners, although currently only four. There's an open seat. They are unelected and unaccountable. They're appointed by Governor Cuomo and confirmed by the Senate. And basically, they have a very cozy relationship with the private utilities, where they're under regulatory capture pretty much. Because the system is so technical and inaccessible, there's rarely anybody in the room when their decisions are being made that can challenge the dominant market-based dogma that's kind of underlying their decisions. So the PSC, in fact, every state has a comparable body that regulates utilities, and we really think of them as a choke point. 50 states, 50 commissions, and about 5 commissioners on each, and it really ends up being that 250 people in the country control half the carbon. And these are pretty bureaucratic rooms and systems that are totally unused to adversarial presences like ours, and they feel very uncomfortable about inviting the people into the space, and it's actually, because they're so unused to it, we can exert quite a lot of power. The utility system is the private utilities, they've done everything that they can to slow down the transition to renewable energy while claiming otherwise. They've crippled investment into community-owned energy. They have prioritized investor profits over maintaining the grid. For example, after Hurricane Sandy, the Utility Workers Union of America, which organizes 8,000 Con Ed workers, they came out with a report that was pretty scathing, that said that Con Edison appears to operate its electric distribution system based on a policy of run it until it fails. The system features aging and, in spots, deteriorating physical infrastructure. And so, you know, we see this also in places like Northern California, where they're the largest private utility company in the country, Pacific Gas and Electric. Their equipment was responsible for starting the Paradise Fire last year and destroying the town of Chico, and now PG&E is in bankruptcy because of it. Probably one of the first major corporations in the United States to declare bankruptcy because of climate change. In New York, and in the Northeast in general, energy rates are extremely regressive. So low-income neighborhoods experience energy poverty. The burden of energy costs fall most heavily on these communities, and it's not unusual at all for somebody to feel every month like they have to make a choice between choosing to pay for their energy bills, medical bills, and their rent. And I don't think it's a coincidence that DSA has been focusing on housing, healthcare, and energy as some of our main campaign focuses. When someone can't pay their energy bill, the utility will shut off their energy. And this is, for me, a really acute example of how capitalism punishes poverty and criminalizes it. In New York, when your meter is seized, you can have your children taken away from you. The building that you live in can be condemned. So we are going to be starting, we've been mapping out areas where there's a high energy cost burden. That is areas where energy bills make up a huge percentage of someone's monthly income. And we're planning to canvass these areas. This year, Con Edison has initiated a rate case, and that means that they want to increase rates for their whole service area, which is the 5 boroughs plus Westchester. And the Public Service Commission has to approve any requests to increase rates. But again, because of the relationship between the commission and the company, there's historically been very little room to push back on that. Some of the things they're demanding are, for example, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into the liquefied natural gas plant that they own in Astoria. And to, you know, when a utility makes that kind of investment, they are assuming that that is going to be around for another 30 years, 40 years. So they're really like, it's there, it's transparent. They're like, they have no intention of phasing out these fossil fuel infrastructure, you know, toxic pieces, like equipment. You know,
well, yeah, I mean, their entire kind of business model is dependent on delivering these products, right? And if we have the ability to do things, you know, like they make money off delivering gas to our homes. They don't care that it's contributing to climate change. And, you know, if everybody was heating their homes with geothermal or air source heat pumps, then they don't have a product to deliver. If everybody is having community solar or solar on the roofs, they don't have a product to deliver anymore. So, you know, their business model is being put before the health and safety and the entire survival of the whole planet. And I thought something you said was really interesting, right? You know, so we all get energy bills. We get them in our mail all the time or online. You know, you get your electricity bill, you get your natural gas bill. So it's just something that touches everyone's life very deeply. Yet you're talking about this process that is very undemocratic. And we'll be opening up the phone line soon, so we definitely would love to hear from the audience. You know, have you ever had your electricity shut off? What kind of electricity do you want delivered to your home? But I'd like to, you know, dive in a little bit more to, like, some of these tactics that utility companies are using. In Westchester, right before frack gas storage had to be approved or not, Con Ed declared a moratorium. And they had all the big real estate developers, all big businesses kind of freaking out about, well, if we don't have new gas, we're not going to have any economic development, and kind of pushing to lock us into this fossil fuel economy we know we need to get off of. National Grid has done, you know, threatened to do the same thing here in New York City if the Williams pipeline isn't approved. It just really seems that this is this kind of thing where they're still trying to control the energy system. You know, what's your kind of take on what the utilities have been doing and how, and what can be the vision of what we could build instead?
Yeah, I think that they're doing a pretty masterful job of forcing everybody else to operate from a place of fear and to use these threats to kind of make us think that we need the private utility companies to make our world run. And ultimately, our long-term vision is to bring privately owned utilities into public ownership and to show that we really can make a change in how our economy is structured. I think that, let's say, the Amazon campaign has been really inspiring for many of us to see that, like, we can take on a company that's worth, you know, many billions of dollars and win. Con Ed has much more deeply rooted ties to the area, so I think it's a harder target in some ways. But I think that we can win. In fact, we need to if we want to have a, you know, safe environment and stop being complicit in the destruction of our communities.
Lauren, as somebody who kind of worked on some of these bigger, broader Green New Deal principles, and how do you see this kind of fitting in, this local work that's happening to kind of fulfill that vision, and what's going on?
Sure. Well, at the biggest level, I think this local work is integral. You know, we need to nationalize
oil companies. We need to bring these private corporations that control our energy into public ownership, as Gustavo said, because we are running out of time and our carbon budget is, 420 gigatons, according to the latest IPCC report. And we need that to transition our economy, our culture, our society. And when I say we, I mean like everyone, the whole world. So we don't have time to wait for these dawdling companies trying to hang on to a model that is so dangerous and has been proven dangerous. And I think, you know, New York isn't the only city that's doing an energy campaign. There's one in Providence. I think there is also going to be one out west where the Chico fire happened. They are putting these issues front and center in local communities, and this grows our movement. They'll continue gaining steam until we win.
Cool. And Gustavo, I just want to go back to Con Ed's rate case a little bit. So just to break this down, so everybody, we get our bills in the month. And so pretty much Con Ed is proposing to raise that rate. And in this rate case, they're going to lay out all the different things that they want to spend money on. And they're not really used to having the public be a part of that process. DSA wants them to be very much a part of this project. So what are some of the things you're looking to talk to people about as you go canvassing? What are the important things that you think, what part of the public voice needs to be more a part of this process?
Well, to begin with, there are two tracks within the rate case, essentially. If you are going to become an official party, it's called becoming an intervener to the case, which DSA, the Eco-Socialist Working Group, has done. That is like the internal work, let's say, that traditionally only lawyers participate in. There is also a track for public statement hearings that the Department of Public Service, because it is intended to act in the interest of the public, they're required to hold. But this is one of the ways that they've made participating in the system so difficult historically. There are rate cases about every 3 years, in 2013 and 2016. The public hearings were held only one held for all of New York City in Lower Manhattan, in like the Wall Street area. And it was, I think one year it was held at 4:30 PM and the other at 5:30. And so if you're living in one of the most energy cost burdened communities, and you may be working multiple full-time jobs multiple part-time jobs, et cetera, like it's really impossible to go to a public statement hearing. So our first demand that we've started working on is to get more public hearings scheduled and to have them in points to have them occur before the major decisions are made, so that public input can affect what the arguments that are being made within the intervener process, how that unfolds. And hopefully once we get those dates, we're going to be canvassing to turn people out to the public hearings in large numbers, so that we can really provide an alternative vision to the way the utility company wants to run the energy system in the state. I think it's really, really great that so many DSA chapters across the country have taken on this kind of work in Providence, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, and East Bay DSA. Like, these are all chapters that have really made this a priority.
And if you want to get involved in the New York City rate case, you can go to bit.ly, that's L-Y, /NYCDSA Energy. And you're listening to WBAI Revolutions Per Minute. We're going to open up the phone lines. You can call in at 212-209-2877. Talk to us about your energy. We're all paying energy bills. Maybe you're also at the youth climate strikes this week. We would love to hear from you. Again, our number is 212-209-2877. Give us a call. Tell us how your energy is going. Another thing I'd really like to talk about, too, in far as the principles of a Green New Deal, is that, you know, there's, especially in some communities in the South, communities that were not actually, that didn't prosper because of the original New Deal. A lot of Black Americans didn't get that same prosperity. And I think some environmental justice groups originally felt a little bit left out of the maybe initial proposal. Lauren, can you talk a little bit more about how environmental justice and kind of centering communities of color, low-income communities, indigenous communities, how that was a part of the DSA Eco-Socialist Working Group process?
Sure. You know, as I mentioned, when the initial resolution came out, we saw how the Climate Justice Alliance and the Indigenous Environmental Network and Cooperation Jackson, they put forward these great statements. And we recognized that these communities can be these communities are, you know, we have to follow their lead. They've experienced such injustice and hardship at the hands of the current system that, you know, we have to do it right this time.
And we have a caller. Caller, you are live on WBAI.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Hi there. So I'm calling because I just had a very interesting awakening regarding our energy system in New York and the States. I was basically recently started to get so I started having a problem holding my phone. And also being in front of my computer and my Prius. And a friend gave me a tri-field meter and said, you know, you should test your company and then test your house and see if you're having any issues. I did. A tri-field meter, for anybody who doesn't know, is it measures electromagnetic field, which is by Milligoff. And I went to my company and to my home and found out that my my house was at between 15 and 29 ambient in the living room and in the bedroom. And I had also been exhibiting lots of health issues before that. Are you still there?
Yes, yep, we can still hear you.
That was, as far as I knew, very high. So I called Con Edison right away and my landlord to see if there was anything we could do about this sort of dirty electricity problem. And we ended up, you know, Con Edison ended up calling me. They came within the hour. And they said that they didn't, they thought that it was probably high as far as the
I don't know if we can hear you anymore. Are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah. So basically what happened was the Con Edison guys came. I told them that the Milligoss meter reading was really, really high. They agreed and said that it was probably a problem with my landlord. My landlord called several electricians to see if the building was grounded, and then an EMF specialist in, and who indeed confirmed that the electromagnetic fields in the building were extremely high. We then went up and down the streets in Brooklyn and realized that it was high everywhere. And since then, I've found that actually the Con Edison is unregulated, as all most power companies are unregulated in the city, and that we were all being exposed to very high electromagnetic fields. And this field, the milligauss, for instance, in Europe, everything is regulated for under 5 milligauss. So if you know, it's like 0.6 milligauss. Anything over 5 milligauss in electromagnetic field is considered.
Yeah, I think this highlights, you know, what exactly we're talking about, where, you know, there's problems in our system and Con Ed isn't really, you know, their biggest concern is their profit and not what's happening. So thank you so much for sharing that story. If anybody else has stories about energy, if your electricity has been shut off, what you would like to see in a Green New Deal, please give us a call at 212-209-2877. Gustav, I want to talk a little bit too about how people can get involved in these campaigns and what that's going to be looking like going forward for the Energy Rights Campaign and DSA's involvement in the Con Ed rate case.
So our first canvas is going to happen the first weekend of April. And if you want to participate, I would highly encourage it. You can sign up for the campaign mailing list at bit.ly/NYCDSAEnergy. That's bit.ly/NYCDSAEnergy. And you know, for me, canvassing was really an awakening politically in many ways. I canvassed a lot for political electoral campaigns last summer, and it's socialists. You know, we need to have our finger on the pulse of what the working class's concerns are, and I think it'll be really a really good experience to talk to our neighbors about these problems and to try to get new people in the struggle to defeat the private utilities. We will have our next general meeting for the working group also in the first week of April, and you can always see when those are at the calendar at socialists.nyc.
And we have another caller on the line. Caller, you're live on WBAI.
Okay, this is me, right?
Yes, yep. We can hear you.
Okay, good afternoon. Congratulations for the work you do, and thank you very much. Your work is very important, and keep educating our people, because the people in, I guess you could say, in the rulership right now, they're consumed by greed. And what they'll do if we don't do anything, they'll just destroy this world, because they're going to be dead in a couple of days, and they're just going to leave us a lot of problems, you know, and make it difficult for us to live. They're on their way out, so they don't really care, you know. So we have to be very vigilant and very committed to the work we do, because we got to think about our children and our grandchildren and the new world we're going to usher in. And it's already coming in. You know, you can see it in yourself and people like the good senator from Minnesota and the lady from New York, Ms. Ocasio. So continue the good work, and what you're doing is educating. I think that's the most important thing right now, is to educate and prepare these young people, because we are going to make this a better world. Thank you so very much again, and have a very good day.
Thanks, and thanks so much for calling. And, you know, I've been doing organizing around stopping fracking infrastructure, climate change for about 6 years now. And I think seeing these youth movements like the Climate Strikers and Sunrise has personally given me a lot of hope that I haven't seen in a long time. And part of what's so refreshing about it, I think, is just the absolute unwillingness to kind of bend towards any sort of capitalism and saying, you know, this is the climate science. This is what needs to be done for our futures to have a future, and just that boldness and that willingness to realize that, you know, what Greta Thunberg is talking about isn't just ending fossil fuels. She's talking about a whole economic shift. And that's pretty amazing to hear 15-year-olds talking about that. Have you guys been inspired by these youth movements? And
oh, yeah, it's amazing. It's tremendous. I mean, I was their age, and climate change was a subject in science class, and that was about it. And people made jokes about Al Gore and laughed it off. And now we have a generation of kids who are unwilling to accept excuses and old tactics and strategies, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there were students at Columbus Circle, you know, talking about how capitalism is causing problems in Puerto Rico, and that we're going to, you know, we're potentially, that all the stuff that we're doing with Venezuela is all about oil. And I know that was not on my radar when I was 15 years old at all. I mean, just again, I want to, if you want to get involved in this campaign, you can follow NYCDSA_climate on Twitter. Again, the link to get involved in the Con Ed rate case and eco-socialist working group is bit.ly/NYCDSA. Energy. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in NYC, broadcasting at 99 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. You can follow us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Have a great Tuesday, and we'll see you next week.